Our text this afternoon is made up of 1 Kings 9, verses 10 to 24. But we're going to read a passage first out of 1 Kings 7, and then we'll read, beginning with our text, through the end of chapter 9. We're going to read 1 Kings 7, the first 12 verses, which speak of Solomon's palace which he built. But Solomon was building his own house 13 years, and he finished all his house. He built also the house of the forest of Lebanon. The length thereof was 100 cubits, and the breadth thereof 50 cubits, and the height thereof 30 cubits, upon four rows of cedar pillars, with cedar beams upon the pillars. And it was covered with cedar above upon the beams that lay on 45 pillars, 15 in a row. There were windows in three rows, and light was against light in three ranks. And all the doors and posts were square with the windows, and light was against light in three ranks. And he made a porch of pillars. The length thereof was 50 cubits, and the breadth thereof 30 cubits. And the porch was before them, and the other pillars and the thick beam were before them. Then he made a porch for the throne where he might judge, even the porch of judgment, and it was covered with cedar from one side of the floor to the other. And his house where he dwelt had another court within the porch, which was of the like work. Solomon made also an house for Pharaoh's daughter, whom he had taken to wife, like unto this porch. All these were of costly stones, according to the measures of huge stones, sawed with saws within and without, even from the foundation unto the coping, and so on the outside toward the great court. And the foundation was of costly stones, even great stones, stones of 10 cubits and stones of 8 cubits. And above were costly stones, after the measures of huge stones and cedars. And the great court round about was with three rows of huge stones and a row of cedar beams, both for the inner court of the house of the Lord and for the porch of the house. We'll be explaining some of that in the sermon. We turn now to 1 Kings 9, reading verses 10 to the end of the chapter and taking verses 10 to 24 as our text. And it came to pass at the end of 20 years, when Solomon had built the two houses, the house of the Lord and the king's house. Now Hiram the king of Tyre had furnished Solomon with cedar trees and fir trees and with gold according to all his desire. That then King Solomon gave Hiram 20 cities in the land of Galilee. And Hiram came out from Tyre to see the cities which Solomon had given him, and they pleased him not. And he said, "What cities are these which thou hast given me, my brother?" And he called them the land of Kabul unto this day. And Hiram sent to the king 60 talents of gold. And this is the reason of the levy which King Solomon raised, for to build the house of the Lord and his own house, and Millo, and the wall of Jerusalem, and Hazor, and Megiddo, and Gezer. For Pharaoh, king of Egypt, had gone up and taken Gezer, and burnt it with fire, and slain the Canaanites that dwelt in the city, and given it for a present unto his daughter, Solomon's wife. And Solomon built Gezer, and Beth-horon the nether, and Baalath, and Tadmor in the wilderness, in the land, and all the cities of store that Solomon had, and cities for his chariots, and cities for his horsemen, and that which Solomon desired to build in Jerusalem, and in Lebanon, and in all the land of his dominion. And all the people that were left of the Amorites, Hittites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites, which were not of the children of Israel, their children that were left after them in the land, whom the children of Israel were also not able utterly to destroy, upon those did Solomon levy a tribute of bond service unto this day. But of the children of Israel did Solomon make no bondmen, but they were men of war, and his servants, and his princes, and his captains, and rulers of his chariots, and his horsemen. These were the chief of the officers that were over Solomon's work, 550, which bear rule over the people that wrought in the work. But Pharaoh's daughter came up out of the city of David unto her house, which Solomon had built for her. Then did he build Millo. And three times in the year did Solomon offer burnt offerings and peace offerings upon the altar which he built unto the Lord, and he burnt incense upon the altar that was before the Lord. So he finished the house. And King Solomon made a navy of ships in Ezion-Geber, which is beside Eloth on the shore of the Red Sea in the land of Edom. And Hiram sent in the navy his servants, shipmen that had knowledge of the sea, with the servants of Solomon. And they came to Ophir and fetched from thence gold, 420 talents, and brought it to King Solomon. We read God's word this far. Beloved saints in Jesus Christ, the glory of a great kingdom is often displayed in its official buildings. The United States of America has a very fabulous and magnificent Capitol building and a beautiful place for the president to live, the White House. These function in an official way. They're places where the government carries out its work, but as a sign of the glory of the nation, they are magnificent pieces of architecture. There is a memorial to Lincoln and a monument to Washington in Washington, D.C. And these serve a historical purpose of reminding us of these men and what they did. But again, these buildings are impressive pieces of architecture. The glory of the kingdom in the eyes of men is reflected in these buildings. That's true not only of a nation. It's true of a rich man when he builds a house. He wants that house to display the glory of his riches. That's true of a corporation, perhaps, when it builds its headquarters. The headquarters is the most lavish building in the whole of the corporation. Our text speaks of the building projects that King Solomon undertook in addition to the temple. And we see that they also were magnificent and glorious. The question that we have before us this afternoon is just what were all these building projects and how did they show the glory of the kingdom? Was it entirely an earthly glory of an earthly kingdom, or, and this we will find in fact to be true, was there not something here also that pictured for us the kingdom of Jesus Christ? Call your attention to this under the theme, Solomon's building projects. First of all, notice that they were extensive. Secondly, that they were expensive. And finally, that they were glorious. Solomon didn't undertake a small building project here or there. His projects were extensive. First of all, we notice that he built his own palace. Our text speaks of that in verse 15, simply making reference to the fact that he built his own house. But chapter 7, the first 12 verses, as we read of them, describe that palace for us. I'm not going to be able to help you visualize exactly the layout of this palace, but what does become clear, and we can understand this much, are the different parts of the palace and the expense of that palace. We're told in verse 1 of chapter 7 that Solomon built his own house and that it took him 13 years. That's something of a heading, because the rest of the verses that we read in chapter 7, 1 through 12, all speak of that palace. Really a complex of different connected buildings. The chapter begins then by telling us about a house called the House of the Forest of Lebanon. One of the buildings that made up the palace in which he lived. 150 feet long, 75 feet high, and 45 feet wide. As wide as the temple, but taller and longer rather as tall as the temple, but longer and wider considerably. This was an extensive project in itself. It's called the House of the Forest of Lebanon because of the prominence of the cedar in that house. As we read, there were cedar pillars, on top of which were cedar beams, and then the house was covered with cedar above the beams. Extensive use of cedar. The question especially is, what function did this building serve? And the answer is, it was something of an armory and a treasury. It was the place where Solomon put some of his weapons of war and especially some of his riches. We read in 1 Kings 10, verses 16 and 17, that King Solomon made 200 targets of beaten gold. 600 shekels of gold went to one target, and 300 shields of beaten gold, 3 pound of gold went to one shield, and the king put them in the House of the Forest of Lebanon. The second building that made up the complex of his palace was a porch of pillars, of which we read in verse 6. He made a porch of pillars. The length thereof was 50 cubits and the breadth 30 cubits. So again, 75 feet by 45 feet. And the porch was before them. And the other pillars and the thick beam were before them. We think of a porch, we think sometimes of an covered approach to a building, our front porch or our back porch. But apparently this porch was a covered or an enclosed room. It had, we're told, another porch before it, which indicates that it wasn't the main entrance to the palace, but it may very well have been the large and primary reception hall. No other indication of the function of this room is given. The columns, 45 cedar pillars, give it, or rather many pillars, we're not told how many in that porch, give it a very stately appearance. The third building in this complex was his throne room. Then made he a porch for the throne where he might judge, even the porch of judgment. Again, that it's a porch does not mean that it's unenclosed. But the function of the room is very clear. Here is the place where his great throne is found. That throne is described in chapter 10, verses 18 through 20. Moreover, the king made a great throne of ivory and overlaid it with the best gold. The throne had 6 steps, and the top of the throne was round behind. There were stays on either side of the place of the seat, and 2 lions stood beside the stays. And 12 lions stood there on the one side and on the other side upon the 6 steps. There was not the like made in any kingdom. A throne that you approach by climbing 6 steps with lions on either side to show the power and the dignity and the royalty of the king. That throne is put into this porch of judgment, also covered with cedar. That was the third. We have the House of the Forest of Lebanon. We have the Porch of Pillars, which may have been a great reception room. We have the Hall of Judgment. Then we have Solomon's own dwelling place. His house where he dwelt had another court within the porch. And we have, fifthly, the house that he made for Pharaoh's daughter, who was his wife. That's one of the projects that Solomon built and undertook, and it all by itself was very extensive, so that, as we read, it took 13 years for him to build. But in addition, our text speaks of other building projects that he undertook. Some of them were within and immediately around Jerusalem itself. We read that he built the wall of Jerusalem, verse 15, and that he built Millo, a word which comes up a number of times in our text. The wall of Jerusalem is clearly that wall all around the city which would defend the city from attacks. There must have been a wall already. But evidently, Jerusalem is expanding its borders. It's growing, perhaps, in population, and it's growing in size as he constructs a large temple and a large palace complex so that he must add to the wall of Jerusalem. Millo was, and the word literally means fortress, was the keep, the stronghold in Jerusalem, like the keep of the castle, which if the enemy breached the wall itself, all the inhabitants of Jerusalem, especially the important government officials, would go into this fortress, this keep, and they could from there try to defend themselves against the enemies. Those clearly served the purpose of defense. Not only in Jerusalem, but in other parts of his kingdom, he also builds defense cities. In the near northwest part of the tribe territory that the 12 tribes were given, up towards Tyre, in the direction now of the Mediterranean Sea, he built the cities of Hazor and Megiddo. Farther south, but along the western edge of his kingdom, toward the land of the Philistines, he built cities: Gezer, Bethhoron, the Nether, which means the lower, as the word Netherlands means low lands, and Baalath. And then up toward Syria, he built a city called Tadmor. These cities were all strategically located near his borders, not immediately on them, but they would be a first line of defense if one of the enemies came in from that direction. And notice he built them near the Philistines, who had been historically enemies of Israel, and the Phoenicians. Although he and Hiram are on good terms, there are other nations there who have historically been enemies of Israel, and the Syrians, who had and later on would invade the land of Israel again. Not only does he build cities for defense, but he builds store cities. So that we read in verse 19 that these cities were cities of store for his chariots and his horsemen, and other food and supplies for the army. We've gone over very briefly all of the building projects, what they all were, but just this survey of them immediately impresses on us that they were extensive in scope. He builds a huge palace. He builds whole cities. They were extensive in size. The palace complex, we are told by secular historians, was four times larger than the whole temple complex. And they are extensive in cost. Is Solomon, in building these, show his wisdom? Is he like any other earthly king, lifted up in pride, wanting the nations around to see what a force he is to be reckoned with? Is he inflamed with a sense of his greatness? Well, we don't exactly know any of all his motivations. We do emphasize, though, that in building these, he is showing himself a servant of Jehovah, and showing he's devoted to the well-being of the kingdom. That throne room was going to serve the purpose of judgment. It was flashy. It was attractive. It caught your eye. But it was going to be used to judge in the name of Jehovah God. These fortresses and defenses were notable. The psalmist says, walk about Zion, count her towers, look at how defended she is. And yet, Solomon built them in his desire that the kingdom stay strong and that the peace and the prosperity that Jehovah had given him, he could maintain in the event a nation invaded. The point is not to say that Solomon was not at all inflamed with his greatness. It's very likely that our text is describing the beginning of his downfall that will later show itself in his transgression of the law of God. But at the same time, it must not be said that Solomon is only thinking of himself and his glory. He has in mind the kingdom that Jehovah has given him to rule over, and he shows his love for that kingdom in his desire to defend her from enemies. So that in this work of building these buildings, Solomon stands as a picture of Jesus Christ building the church and preparing heaven. Now, when we notice the building of the temple itself, we made special application to the work of Jesus Christ building the church. But what we must see is that it's not the temple only that's a picture of Christ's church and kingdom. The whole nation was. So that all of the defenses that Solomon built say something about the church of Jesus Christ. And especially the heart of the kingdom, Jerusalem, was. And we know that because the church, as John sees it in Revelation, in heaven is called the New Jerusalem. Jesus Christ builds his church, and he builds that church into a kingdom. And now more specifically, in that church and kingdom, Jesus Christ makes a place for himself, just as Solomon built himself a dwelling place. That place for himself that Jesus Christ makes is a place of great glory. We know that. We know it to be the place at God's right hand. The place where Jesus Christ appears as head of the church and of Lord of all creation and history. I say that Jesus Christ built that place, not denying that God gave it to him, but God gave it to him in the way of his own death on the cross and obedience to the will of his Father. The throne of justice that Solomon built is a picture for us of the justice of Jesus Christ and his continual work of judging in his kingdom. That throne, remember, and the justice that happened there wasn't justice against the Philistines and against the other nations to judge them, to fight them. Solomon had to leave the throne room and had to go off with his army to the edges of his kingdom. That never happened, I realize. His was a time of peace. But the point is that on the throne, he judged Israelites. On the throne, he judged those who were under his sphere of authority, who were the covenant people of God, but who transgressed the law. So Jesus Christ, in his kingdom, is always judging those in the church of Jesus Christ on earth who do not keep his law, both through the work of the elders, but also in our own consciences. That judgment comes to every one of us. And just imagine the glory of this Christ as we stand before him in judgment, even in our own consciences, as we see a throne, Solomon's now, with 12 lions, a picture of the lion of the tribe of Judah, that formidable beast which instills fear in the hearts of a man. And so Jesus Christ, if his judgment be one of condemnation, instills fear in our hearts. But when he judges in love and on the basis of his own death and pronounces us forgiven of our sins, how that lion becomes a picture of that new heaven and earth, that new kingdom where the lion and the lamb lay down together. Solomon provided for the defenses of his kingdom. Jesus Christ is defending us in our covenant fellowship with God. There are always threats. It may be we have peace with God. We do in Jesus Christ. As Solomon's kingdom was one of peace. But that doesn't mean that the threats were gone. He was wise in a time of peace to strengthen the defenses. So does Jesus Christ, having bought His people and made peace with God on our behalf, defend us against our enemy, the devil, using means such as the preaching of the gospel and the sacraments and Christian discipline, putting men on the watchtowers of the church as office bearers, even more giving us His word, which when we take heed to, we know we are safe. And all this work of Jesus Christ, building up His kingdom, judging, defending, and preserving, is an extensive work. He never sleeps. He's constant. He's vigilant in His care of His church. He knows the boundaries of His kingdom. That is, He knows where each and every of His children are for whom He died, and He protects us all. And this shows His undying love for His church as Solomon loved Israel. He preserves all that He died to purchase and to redeem. And so you and I, who have in us the life of Jesus Christ, must also be diligent in defending the church from error, error of doctrine, error of sinful walk and life, defending the church so that her glory and her peace is preserved. Clearly, all of these projects involved great expense. The expenses, and our text speaks of them, were of two kinds. In the first place, Solomon needed the materials for his building projects. We're told in verse 11 that he had received many of those materials from Hiram. Not only the building of the temple, but also the building of Solomon's palace was furnished with cedar trees, fir trees, and gold from Hiram. But this was not a gift that Hiram gave. Hiram charged for these. Solomon must buy these. And you get an idea of the enormity of this, of these materials when we see that Hiram gave Solomon gold according to all his desire in verse 11. And that verse 14 says, Hiram sent to the king 60 talents, 120 talents of gold, which is estimated to have weighed 7,500 pounds, almost 4 tons of gold. Solomon has to buy these somehow. He tries to make a trade with Solomon, or with Hiram. He gave Hiram 20 cities in the land of Galilee, cities in the northern part of his kingdom that adjoined Hiram, so that for Hiram to take them over was no difficult thing. But when Hiram went to see those cities, which was Solomon's attempt at repaying him for all the materials he sent, Hiram said, "What cities are these which thou hast given me, my brother?" And he called them the land of Kabul, dirtiness, displeasing. Apparently, they were not in the best condition, and Hiram was not happy with them. We're told later in 1 Chronicles that Hiram then gave them back to Solomon, and Solomon had to build them up. He had to put some work into them to make them inhabitable, and then he brought some of his own people to live in those cities. So we're not told just how Solomon finally paid for all these materials. We are told that they cost a lot, and Hiram was not happy with the first terms that Solomon set. In addition to the materials, there was the expense of manpower. Thousands of people were involved in the manual labor of building the cities and the palace. The text says in verse 20 that the leftover Canaanites of the land were put to a tribute of bond service. The Amorites, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, the Jebusites. These are all Canaanites who had once lived and called the land their home. Israel has invaded at the time of Joshua and conquered them. Not all have been put to death. Some are alive yet, but they are subject to Solomon, and he forces upon them a tribute of bond service. I say forces. They didn't have the option, but that's not to overlook that there was a cost involved. They were laborers. They had wages to be given. They had food. They had to eat. And there were 550 overseers, servants, princes, captains, rulers of his chariots, and horsemen of the Israelites who also were hired. You begin to see how maybe this is the beginning of Solomon's decline. On the one hand, it appears that though he goes into debt, though he purchases enormous quantities of materials, that he's able to pay it. We're not told that he put the nation in any long-term debt. And yet, the question is he too extravagant? Is he beginning to serve himself? And I say again, there's no final answer to that question, but let us see that if there was the case that's not all of it, Solomon here is reminding us that there is a cost to the work of the kingdom of Christ being carried out. On the one hand, Jesus Christ paid that cost with not silver or gold, because the building up of the kingdom of Christ could not be done with silver or gold, but with his precious blood. We talked earlier about his preserving and maintaining what he bought, but he bought it there with his blood. And he had sufficient means. Jesus Christ himself does not go into debt to establish his kingdom. He has infinite righteousness. His blood was sufficient because it was the blood of the Son of God himself. And on that basis, he establishes his kingdom. The expenses are paid. And yet, from our viewpoint, we're reminded that as he puts us into service as those bondmen on whom he levies a tribute, there is from you and from me, from our pockets, a cost to be paid in maintaining and preserving the church. Just as any household requires money, just as any business requires money to run and to maintain, to run a kingdom takes money. This is why the Caesar requires us to pay him what he lays hold of our own. And he levies upon us a tax. And this too is why the Church of Jesus Christ on earth requires of its people some money in order to carry out the work of the kingdom. But it isn't only the money. It isn't only what we give to the general fund and the benevolent fund and the building fund. Even more, it's that service, the work, the energy that Christ requires of us. That levy, that tribute of which our text speaks, was not so much one of taxes that Solomon levied on the people, but one of work. And Jesus Christ does that to us too, does he not? There is work to do in the Church of Jesus Christ. There is work to do in raising of children. Work to do in instructing those children. Work to do in many different ways. And it's to those whose lives and souls and bodies he redeemed by his blood that he says, now there's a burden, but my yoke is easy and my burden is light, so that if you think of what Christ requires of you in terms of devoting all your time and all your energy and all your resources to serve Him, and if you say that's a burden, then you and I aren't thankful enough for the great burden that we had, which He took upon Himself and which He bore on our behalf on the tree of the cross. Not a heavy burden, but service is required. Later on, the time Rehoboam was king, the people came to Rehoboam and said, lighten our load. And again, it seems, as you read their request, that they didn't have, first of all, in mind the taxes, but first of all, the amount of energy, the amount of time that Solomon had required of them. They wanted more time for themselves. And if that's true, although, again, from an earthly viewpoint, it may be that they had some legitimate request. But as we apply that to Jesus Christ, that's a question we may never come to Christ with, isn't it? We may never come to Him and say, up until now, the time you've required of me to serve in your kingdom, the use of my possessions you've demanded of me to serve in your kingdom has been too heavy. Will you lighten my load? You can see how there was certainly sin mixed in that request. And it must be that you and I never complain about the service Christ demands of us. That's part of the expense of maintaining His kingdom. But our goal now is to see that all of this wealth and infrastructure and suprastructure, the buildings and everything you couldn't see behind it, all indicated the glory of Solomon's kingdom. Early on in the series, we had a sermon entitled Solomon's Royal Glory, the glory of his kingdom and kingship displayed in the extent of his rule. We especially noticed the boundaries. In chapter 10, if the Lord wills, we will have one more sermon that speaks of the glory from the viewpoint of the wealth and riches of that kingdom. But now, it's the buildings and all the work involved to erect those buildings that speaks of the glory of Solomon's kingdom. You and I don't see it with our earthly eyes, but we see it with eyes of faith, and as much as the Scriptures speak of it. We can't imagine how the earthly Jerusalem was, but we understand it's a picture of a greater glory, the glory of the church, the glory of heaven, which one day we will see. Queen of Sheba heard of that glory and came to see it and left saying, the half was not told me. Now, there's a reason why we underscore that all of this truly spoke of and manifested the glory of Solomon's kingdom. Even the poorest nations of this world, if you were to go tour, and if you were to go tour as part of some official tour group, would show you their most beautiful buildings. And some of the poorest nations of the world have such buildings. But there's a sense in which the building is a lie. The stark reality is that in such a kingdom there are very really two kingdoms. There's the great glory that will show off to our tourists, and there's the other side, how most of the people live. The thing about Solomon's buildings is that they weren't a lie. Oh, not everyone had a palace like Solomon's, but they reflected truly and accurately the glory of the entire kingdom. And that point is what the psalmist impresses on our minds at the end of Psalm 48, verse 12, when he says, "Go around Zion." Takes his child, as it were. "We're going to go for a walk today, son. We're going to go walk around Jerusalem. And I'm going to point out to you every single watchtower. I'm going to point out to you the thickness of the walls. I'm going to point out to you the other defense mechanisms and structures that make up this city. And you're going to see this is a glorious city." And that's true of the Church of Jesus Christ on earth. Already on earth. All the more in heaven. But beginning on earth. Do you see it? You see the glory of Christ? You see the glory of the church? We look at her as she appears on earth and we often say, "No, I don't see it at all." Church on earth, she's beleaguered. She's hunted like a rabbit. She's persecuted. The people who make her up are among the lower class, perhaps, or at least not the rich and the mighty and the famous. As the Apostle says in 1 Corinthians 2, it isn't the noble and the wise of the world who are called. People who make up the church are sinners. I don't see her glory. No, not with earthly eyes, but with eyes of faith. Scripture declares, the preaching of the gospel sets forth, that the glory of the church of Jesus Christ is exactly in this, that she's bought with a price and will never be sold, that she will continue safe and secure forever. You say, yes, she's persecuted. And the enemy attacks her, and that's true. But what other earthly institution is 6,000 years old continuously? That's sometimes appearing more glorious than others in an earthly way. But what other organization has existed throughout all of time and history? The Church of Jesus Christ has. And her glory is that she's one in Him. Our glory is that we are holy, that is, devoted to God and able to serve Him in Jesus Christ. Our glory is that to us is given the truth and the knowledge of the Scriptures and covenant fellowship with God and all covenant blessings. Do you see that glory? Those who sit under the preaching of the pure gospel and hear the Scriptures set forth and despise it all don't see that glory. It takes eyes of faith. And eyes of faith are not the sort of things you and I can go get. They are a gift from God to His people. The glory of the kingdom of Solomon points then to the glory of the kingdom of Christ as now manifested in the church and as will be one day realized in heaven. And then we'll see it more clearly. You read again Revelation 21 and 22 and see the Apostle John describing it in his revelation. The walls of Jerusalem made up of costly gems, streets paved with gold. He's describing a place of glory. The glory of the kingdom of Solomon and the glory of the church reflect the glory of their Maker. By which I mean that even the glory of Solomon's kingdom said something about not just Solomon, but Jehovah. And the glory of the church and of heaven tells us about the glory of our covenant God. There's little hints of that in the text. It doesn't come out explicitly. There's little hints of that. The house Solomon built, the palace, is built next to the temple. And Solomon is emphasizing, this is my beautiful dwelling place. Here's where the official business of this kingdom is carried out. But it's nothing if we forget who lives in the temple, the true king of the kingdom. Now, I say built right next to the temple, but we should emphasize that the temple is built on Mount Moriah and the palace on Mount Zion. So that, in fact, there was something between them. They were on different mountains and there was a valley between them. In order to get to the temple, Solomon built a special passageway for him and his servants from his palace, going down the valley and then up into the temple. There's a little reference to that again in the Queen of Sheba when she comes to visit and she sees the ascent by which Solomon and his servants go up into the temple. It was quite a sight to behold, Solomon and his men using that special pathway to get to the temple, which connected them. It's that pathway that shows the relationship between the two. On the one hand, two mountains, and at the top of each, a glorious edifice, the temple of Jehovah. And the palace of Solomon. And for the person looking at Jerusalem from a distance, especially for the Israelite who understood the significance, the picture was, Solomon is our king, and the kingdom is glorious, but he rules under Jehovah, who lives in the temple. The psalmist understood that. Psalm 48, as he took his son or daughter or grandchild around Jerusalem and pointed out all those defenses and said to his child, now you understand, child, it isn't that we have built a wall that can never be breached. It isn't that we have done something no other man has ever done or would ever do. The strength of Jerusalem does not, first of all, consist of all her defenses, but it consists of this. This God is our God forever and ever. He will be our guide even unto death. You and I know that the church of Christ and the kingdom of Christ will continue forever. Not only because Christ bought her by his blood, but because Christ dwells in close proximity to Jehovah, as did Solomon's palace to the temple. And Christ dwells in close proximity to Jehovah as the servant of Jehovah, the one to realize and carry out the will of God regarding the salvation of his church. Our defenses are not so much things as they are a being, the being of the triune God whom we worship and serve. And therefore, the work that we do in defending and maintaining the church of Jesus Christ as his servants, to whom is given a yoke of bond service, the work we do must also be that of continually looking to our God, pointing our children, pointing each other to our God, and saying of him, see him? The glory of the church is the reflection of his glory. The glory of heaven is the glory of Jehovah himself, Will you be strong? You look for maintenance and preservation. Look to Him alone. When looking to Him, we shall be safe. For this God dwells in us. This God is our God forever and ever. Amen. Heavenly Father, glorify Thy name, and may Thy glory be displayed in the Church of Jesus Christ and in all the work of Christ, defending, maintaining, and building her up, in the work we do as a congregation, in the mission work, in the proclamation of the gospel also to Thy people here and everywhere. May the people redeemed by the blood of Christ see Thy glory and confess Thee to be our rock, our fortress, our tower, and our hiding place. For Jesus' sake, amen.